Hello, business owners, entrepreneurs, and executives. Welcome to today's Business Radio, a new hybrid radio show that airs both on air as well as online and on demand. We discuss all the topics relating to your business. Today's Business Radio interviews experienced business advisors to help you build enterprise value, improve profitability, and plan for your eventual exit. Whether you're an entrepreneur just starting out, a seasoned business owner, or a top-level executive, today's Business Radio will help you achieve your personal and professional goals. Today's Business Radio is available around the clock, around the world, online, and on demand at todaysbusinessradio.com. Now, the host of today's Business Radio, Tom Lyons.
Hello, this is Tom Lyons. I'm here with my co-host, Sam Zordich, and our producer, Jorgie Jorgensen. And our guest today is John Cameron from the Cameron Law Offices.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Sam.
Morning.
John, we've got a real timely topic today, and it's partnership and shareholder disputes. In previous podcasts, we've talked about when you're forming an entity and everybody's happy and everything's good, it's a good time to lay out the groundwork and do your buy-sell agreements and set up your entity and do all those things. But in these economic times, nobody likes to see deals go bad, but they go bad. And sometimes when they go bad, then it leads to these partnership and shareholder disputes problems. I'm sure you're going to tell me if we set this up right in the beginning, they're easier to manage. Your practice must be pretty interesting right now.
It is, Tom. I mean, we're seeing a lot of situations where people came together with very optimistic, a lot of very smart people who had great experience, familiar with the different industries they're involved in. But because of these economic times, they're faced with situations they didn't anticipate, and realistically, many people didn't anticipate. But they, you know, for example, maybe it's an operating entity that needs capital, mm-hmm. but it has several shareholders, but many of the shareholders can't put any capital in. So they need to get together, and you know, hopefully their documents would have provided a roadmap for that capitalization. But many times it doesn't. We have other situations where maybe the corporation and its principals went to a lender and borrowed a significant amount of capital, and now the assets that they acquired with that capital are either way underwater on valuation, not cash flowing, or in serious trouble.
Give an example.
Well, you might have the best example that we have right now is either, you know, a residential development or a commercial development that a client may have got themselves into. Maybe it's even a performing asset, but given the banking situation today, the note has come due, mm-hmm. and the bank will not loan the same amount of funds on that asset that they currently have on. So they want a pay down. So we have situations where there's either a capital requirement to come in, or there's no capital at all, and the lender is looking to enforce the commitments of the corporation and the principals in full.
So then that would trigger you to take a look at the documents that were signed at the time that you borrowed the money from the bank to refresh yourself with what did we agree to at that time. And hopefully they had good legal advice at that time to kind of minimize the problem if it got in a non-performing status.
Well, you know, you would hope that the principals involved would have negotiated or had someone on their behalf negotiating with the lender to limit their liability. You know, we've seen situations where people come in on deals that were done without our assistance, where an individual might own 10% of the entity, but has signed a guarantee with the lender guaranteeing 100% of the debt. And on an asset that's, you know, way underwater. And that individual may have some wherewithal, while the other principals may have lost a significant amount or all of their wherewithal.
So that might have been a situation where they signed the bank note, and then each of the shareholders signed a personal guarantee, which could possibly obligate each of them to up to 100% of the note?
Sure, and there's, you know, a couple things that we would advise a client to do in that situation is, one is to try and negotiate their guarantee down to the percentage of ownership. And second of all, if they can't do anything with the bank, at a minimum, have a cross-indemnification agreement amongst the principals saying that okay, when this, you know, the bank might be able to collect 100% of it from me, but then I'll be able to get your ownership percentage ownership back from my partners or the other principals.
So in the example that we started with, a residential developer, they might have had some property that we thought was worth, say, $5 million. And now with the things happening the last couple of years, that might be valued at 50 to 60% of that.
Right.
And so now that when the loan comes up for renewal, the bank's saying, well, the loan to value isn't near where we thought it was. Now you either need to give us some additional collateral or some you know, or reduce the debt for us to renew it. And now you've got multiple shareholders, and maybe you've got an absentee shareholder and says, this wasn't my problem, these guys messed up. Now you get into some shareholder disputes in addition to the fact that you've got the bank over there staring in the face saying, I want my money back.
Right. I mean, it's a situation at that point where, let's say that an attorney has worked for the entity in organizing it, and now you have partners who now want to enforce the terms of the agreement. And it may be something that maybe one of the partners who was more active in the management of the company didn't manage it properly, or there's allegations that they breached their duties to the corporation and to the shareholders. So maybe these partners are now going to bring a number of claims against each other and counterclaims asserting that either their rights under the agreements that they've signed or alleging some other, you know, activity where the person didn't do their job. I mean, we're seeing situations where not only potential officers who are operating a company may have some potential liability, or even board members, you know, potentially have liability if they have not managed their duties in a way that's consistent with their obligations as a board member.
Now, you're saying all the actions, though, that were being brought among the different board members, right?
Well, these will be primarily between the shareholders.
Or shareholders. Yeah. Okay. So wouldn't, in this example that we're talking about it with the bank, would it be to negate their personal guarantee, or would it be to get off the loan? Would it be to, what would be the purpose of all that litigation when the bank's staring at them, they've got to get this money in?
Well, I mean, they're really two separate issues. One is that, let's just take the bank example. The bank's going to pursue whatever contracts they have and seek to enforce those. Whether there's defenses to those claims or not would have to be evaluated independently. However, you know, if you're the one partner with all the money or most of the money and the bank collects against you, you're then going to turn and want to bring a claim against your partners
right.
to collect your pro rata share of that. So that's kind of the bank example. What we're kind of getting into now is situations where, you know, maybe a shareholder feels that the other shareholder was managing the company. And we see it all the time where potentially there's litigation over maybe somebody's more involved with the company or more involved with the finances, and they felt that they were undercompensated and maybe developed a system internally where they could offset that feeling that they were undercompensated.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, when the other shareholder or shareholders discover this you know, additional compensation plan that they've developed, they may bring a claim and say, listen, you know, that you know, you've been taking corporate assets, you know, you're self-dealing in this case, and as a result, either try to liquidate the, you know, that would, we've talked about, Tom, in the past about documents, and one of the provisions of the shareholder agreement would say, you know, if you breach your duties to the corporation, then we can take you out at a discounted level. So that's the kind of things, you know, we see situations like that where there might be a shareholder who has been taking money from the corporation that they weren't entitled to, which would give rise to a situation. We see actions, shareholder actions, where someone might allege that they've mismanaged the corporation, entered into contracts they weren't authorized. You know, mm-hmm. Again, we talked about it in a prior podcast about the formality of governance, and you know, and maybe somebody's out there just kind of running and doing things and signing contracts, and the, you know, the partners or the board hasn't approved of these. And then someone might say, hey, you know, we need to stop this activity, or your activity has gone so far that you've damaged the corporation, and we're bringing this claim to liquidate your position in the corporation.
John, let's go back to this example with the bank. Now, the asset may have diminished in value, and the bank, before they renew the loan, wants a reduction in the amount due. And you come back to the corporation, and maybe you have to have a capital call of $250,000 or some amount, and you've got some shareholders that can't come up with their capital. How does that work?
Well, you know, typically, you know, let me just back up. On a real estate asset, we typically would have a limited liability company holding those assets. But the question would would be the same no matter how the capital came up. You first go back and look at your shareholder or your member control agreement or your partnership agreement and see if you have a provision in there that says if we need capital, you know, do we need a simple majority to raise, you know, to authorize the capital call? And, you know, this gets difficult when you have 50-50 ownership, and one says, no, we're not putting the money in, the other one says, well, we have to put the money in. So you get into situations where, let's say 51% says, all right, we're making a capital call, and you have to put your money in. And then you have to, if somebody doesn't put it in, you look in your documents to see if there's a way to handle it. If it's not, then you need to find out another way. Maybe it's maybe those members loan the money to the corporation, and they approve terms which they're happy with, and then they make those terms available to all ownership. But if you don't put your money in, you can't participate into this recapitalization. Or, you know, you may get in a situation where you may have to bring an action to liquidate the company. As part of, but that's more difficult to do from a timing perspective, because typically the bank is calling a couple times a day, trying to get the money from the members.
And John, what happens if, say, you've got five members and three of them have deep pockets, and they have to put up this $250,000, and the two that don't have deep pockets can't do it, so the other three put it up? Now they're going to get issued some additional stock or membership interest in the company, and the ones that didn't put it up are going to have a diminished percentage in that company. Does that lead to disputes and lawsuits and things on occasion too?
Well, it potentially could. However, you know, your scenario was pretty clean. You have three of five, and assuming that the ownership interest is that equal to that 3-5, and also that the documentation would allow a simple majority to issue more stock, or you know, another way to do it was the 3 of 5 could vote to that take a loan and pay themselves some, you know, more favorable terms than they would normally have gotten from a bank or somewhere else. But, you know, the way to balance that out is to offer those same terms to the other member, to everyone to participate in. But somehow it's got to get capitalized. Where it gets tougher is, let's say you have four equal owners and two are on one side and two are on the other side, and
they're frozen.
They don't have any ability to authorize the loan or the sale of new membership interest, yet this obligation is still out there and needs to be addressed. Hopefully your documents addressed it, but many times they don't.
That was an example of a company I worked with that had exactly that situation. And how would you resolve or work to resolve that?
In the four equal partners?
Four equal partners. Two were in the company, two were out of the company. The bank loan was up. They had to have it. Personal guarantees brought forward again. There was a capital call. I mean, everything. And one of the partners decided that he wasn't going to play.
You know, we run into that situation a lot. Just did one about in the last a little over a year ago, a development where there were two equal partners in it. One of them didn't have the desire or some limited ability to put any money in. And what we did is we ended up negotiating a compromise. Okay, we'll get you off the loan, or we'll indemnify you from any liability on the loan. But you need to sign over your ownership interest, and in that process, the one owner took over the asset, but was required to put all the capital up.
So do you lock them in the conference room and tell them they can't come out until we resolve this, John? Or how do you do this?
Yeah, really?
Well, I mean, it's a lot of times our role is just to kind of facilitate to lay the options out. We don't make any decisions for anybody. We just tell them, here's your options. And many times, you know, those options are primarily being dictated by the lender.
So you become the mediator.
To a certain degree. But, you know, we're also, you know, dealing with the other side, you know, to negotiate the deal. But in that situation, a lot of people realize that if they don't have the money to put up, and the bank is pushing everyone and it doesn't get funded, then they're going to be in as much trouble as everyone else. So there's a tendency to recognize the situation and try to figure out a way to alleviate it. But sometimes you get in a situation where, you know, we have this as well, where there's a dispute over what the value of that person's interest is, and not only what the value is, but on what basis should it be paid. Cash today. We're involved in a shareholder dispute right now where, I think everyone is getting close to agreeing on what the value should be. However, they have some intellectual property that they want to protect for a period of time, and now the dispute is over what period of time will this individual need to stay away from the industry or the clients of the company. So it gets complicated on when you the interests that you're trying to protect.
Mm-hmm.
So the process then, you sit down and say, here's the LLC, here's the assets of the LLC, here's the loan with the bank and the trouble we're in, here's the owners, who has the ability to participate and take care of the bank and who doesn't, and how do we figure out a way to get out of this problem without getting into litigation with the bank that's going to adversely affect everybody.
Right.
So you're really looking for the easiest avenue to resolve the problem.
Yeah, and in today's situation, I wouldn't say any of them are the easy, but it's the least painful for all involved to preserve the asset and try to live to fight another day.
That's the best way to put it, the least painful.
Right, right.
I'm glad he's not a doctor. We'd be in trouble.
Well, we were talking a little bit before about some of the different actions that banks are taking now in order to preserve the rights or their loans and the validity of them. I was not aware of some of the legal actions that banks were taking.
Well, I mean, when these loans were originated, they're evidenced by a lot of documents. You know, they borrow the money, it's evidenced by a note and secured by a number of things, including mortgages against property, UCC filings against personal property, personal guarantees of principals. So, a lot of documentation was established when these things were originated, and now the banks are saying, in many cases, it turns into a foreclosure. They foreclose their interest on the real estate. They try to take that back, and they try to liquidate it to reduce their loss. And mm-hmm. if there's a deficiency, then they may later come and pursue a guarantee. We've talked about that in other, and it's complicated, and you should talk to an attorney about what the implications of a foreclosure and what your exposure is following that, because there's many ways you can foreclose, and each one has a different impact on your exposure. But, in some situations, you have a bank that won't foreclose, but will just sue on the note and try to get a judgment against the entity and the personal guarantors of that. Later on, they may foreclose.
Let's stop there. If they're not foreclosing, but they're suing on the guarantee, why are they doing that, John?
Well, they want to. Probably their perception is that the borrowers have the resources to bring the loan current or to pay it off.
In addition to the asset that was pledged as collateral for
right.
the loan.
Right. And the bank is probably saying, we don't want that asset. We'd rather have some other asset that you own.
Or maybe saying, we'll take that, but we want other assets as well.
And the bank may believe that they can also come back and in addition to getting the judgment, come back later and foreclose on that asset too.
So they're just keeping all their options open and trying to get the thing resolved in the best possible fashion.
Right.
Now, these just really aren't fun times and fun instances, are they?
Fear makes everyone act out.
Right. It's and everyone is the banks are in a tough position too. They've they have the regulators asking them, this loan isn't performing. What are you doing to bring this to a conclusion? So
And it seems the examiners have changed the rules a little bit because they're looking for more assets to secure the loans than they've ever looked for before. So they've kind of changed the rules on some of the borrowers, haven't they?
Well, I don't deal directly with any regulators, but my perception is that obviously banks are under a much tighter underwriting criteria than they once were.
That's a good way to put it. We've got the attorney with us, Sam.
Yep.
He's going to be very careful choosing those words. Have you heard him say yes or no yet? I haven't. John, what other type of partnership disputes are you seeing among owners? I think the tough times and tough instances show us the character of your partners, and you really find out who they are. But are you getting into minority shareholder suits? Are you getting into those type of actions today more than you have before?
Well, it runs the gamut. When you're an owner in a company, and a lot of times, we've seen examples over the years of someone just having maybe a 10% interest in a company, and they were there the day it was organized, and they're probably compensated well, and they've liked their job. However, in one particular instance where a person was felt they were compensated well, liked their job, wasn't really interested in selling their interest in the company, were just kind of happy at that level, but watched as the 90% owner was taking certain action that would potentially create a tax liability for not only the corporation but for the shareholders, and put this person in a very difficult position because they had to come and raise raise those types of issues with the 90% person. But we were able to get involved, explain why the activity of the 90% would not only be bad for our client, but would be bad for the corporation and for the 90% person. And it ended up being resolved quite to everyone's satisfaction, and get them back to where they were when they started the company many years ago. But
now, of course, I'm curious sitting here, what was that action?
Well, if you get in situations where you're writing certain things off or taking certain action on accounting basis that might the IRS or some other state of Minnesota or somebody else may not agree with that, or proposing more accurately, proposing to take that action. And if you're just 10% owner, you're kind of saying, what's my role? We had to explain to the client that, you have a very significant role here in the event that the proposed, conduct were to go forward, you could potentially have some liability here. And by raising that and being able to advise that client, then go back to the corporation and say, here's why we think this shouldn't be handled the way you're proposing to do it, we were able to, help that client avoid a potential exposure down the road.
John, I think there's an interesting example, and let's say you've got that 90-10 situation, and the 10% is maybe inactive or a casual shareholder, not active in the operation of the business, but the 90% shareholder is and signs the checks and does everything, what's the liability situation for those two in terms of payroll taxes, for instance? It's my understanding that he who signs the checks and he who handles the cash flow of the company and is the shareholder could be potentially liable personally for the failure to pay employment taxes in a timely fashion. Is that 10% shareholder that's not active in the company going to be exposed to that?
Two questions, Tom. What did you know? Actually, three questions. What did you know? When did you know it? And what did you do after you knew it? So, it's our advice to our clients that if you're not the signer, and it becomes, you become aware that there's some activity going on that shouldn't be going on, and you don't take any action to try to deter that, some taxing authority may come in and find that you are liable for that.
What type of action could you take as a minority shareholder to prevent, the IRS from coming after you for failure to pay employment taxes?
Well, I think that what you would want to do is immediately, if you knew it wasn't being done, is you'd want to bring it to you first want to raise it with the other ownership, put that on record that you have objected, and then you need to ask yourself, is it serious enough where you may want to bring that to the attention to the taxing authority? Each situation is unique, and you need to look at it to see what the potential exposure is. But I think you need to assume that between, if you were aware of the conduct and you took no action or didn't object to it, that you potentially could have some exposure.
I'm looking at this and thinking, I scoffed at the monthly board meetings. Nuh-uh. Should be a checklist. Discuss this.
So this would be a place where you'd want to send a formal letter to the chief operating officer that's not paying it, and maybe send a letter to the board saying, I object to the fact that he's not paying this in a timely fashion, and have some record that you went on record saying, this is wrong, let's pay these things.
Right, and then in one of our prior podcasts, we talked about minutes from board, one of the things it was discussed that so-and-so recommended we do this. And then, that's at a board level. From an officer's position or board level position, you may want to even consider resigning. It becomes more complicated even yet when you're an owner and you have your own part of the company, which may have some value, yet this particular person is taking some action which may expose the corporation and all the owners to some personal liability.
John, what I keep hearing throughout all of these podcasts and more today is that if you're organized properly and professionally and thoroughly organized and keep your minutes up to date and try to do everything to the best of your ability, some of these things can be head off and some of these problems potentially won't be as big as they could be if you're not organized properly with your bylaws and your minutes and your buy-sell agreements and all the rest of that. I keep hearing from you again and again. Let's anticipate these things. Let's organize it. Let's be as organized and as disciplined as possible. And that has the ability to minimize some of these troubles, doesn't it?
Well, I think you're right on it, Tom. I mean, even the example I gave you with regards to the potential 10% owner, that was a situation that was just kind of coming to a head. Nothing had really taken place at that point. Yet it was really good that we had an opportunity to raise it with the other owner and say that it needed to be done a different way. And while that might have been a very difficult conversation for the minority owner to have, it was the right thing for everyone involved. Mm-hmm. And ultimately turned out where it didn't impact the business relationship or the partnership at all.
And also in these examples with the bank, the original bank documents when you're borrowing the loan or borrowing the money, those are very important to go through those and negotiate them properly before you get the money, in the event that something goes bad down the road.
Right. That's right, Tom.
So the more you can negotiate with the bank up front and limit the liability to your shareholders' interests and those kind of things, it may pay off going forward if you run into some kind of distress.
That's right.
Any final thoughts about partnership and shareholder disputes and avoiding those things?
I think that early on there's a tendency for people to let things kind of boil over to a point where they can't be repaired. The example I gave you is one where we got out ahead of something and everyone was able to benefit from it and maintain their relationship. Others aren't so lucky. They come later. So I think it's good to have someone involved, a professional, an attorney, your accountant, all your advisors involved that can help you kind of head these problems off as they arise.
John, thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Lyons, and for my co-host Sam Zordich and our producer Georgie Jorgensen, I'd like to thank John Cameron from the Cameron Law Offices for being with us on this segment of todaysbusinessradio.com.
You've been listening to Today's Business Radio with host Tom Lyons. Tom is the owner of Phelan Partners Limited, an M&A advisory and consulting firm. Today's Business Radio is also available around the clock and around the world at todaysbusinessradio.com. That's todaysbusinessradio.com. All content provided by Today's Business Radio is provided for general information only and should not be treated as a substitute for professional advice from your legal, accounting, and business advisors. Today's Business Radio is not liable for the contents of this podcast, nor does it endorse any commercial product or service mentioned or advised in this podcast. All radio shows, podcasts, and other content provided by Today's Business Radio is copyrighted and may not be reproduced or downloaded for any reason without prior written consent by Today's Business Radio. If you have a topic you'd like covered at Today's Business Radio, log on to our website at todaysbusinessradio.com and submit your comments and questions. Thanks for listening to todaysbusinessradio.com.